This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington. Neil Conan is off. Flip-flopper. It is one of the most common attacks that candidates level at one another during campaigns, and it sets up the notion in at least some voters' minds that politicians all too frequently betray their core convictions for a short-term political game. Or maybe not. Maybe a change in position is no flip-flop, but rather a reasoned evolution in a leader's thinking, pragmatic decisions made slowly and carefully over time. We get to change our minds, right? Can't politicians do the same thing? Well, the way you answer that question, how you spot and measure inconsistency, may depend less on what the politician said and did than on you, on how your brain is wired, what group you think that you belong to. There's a bit of science in play here, and you will be surprised by what it suggests when we hear from NPR science correspondents John Hamilton, Elise Spiegel, and Shankar Vedantam, who explored some of this earlier today on Morning Edition. And there is a link to that piece on our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Later on in the program, women, birth control, and the Catholic Church on the opinion page. But first, John Hamilton, Elise Spiegel, and Shankar Vedantam join us here in Studio 3A. It's nice to have all of you here.
Nice
and,
to be here.
And John, we're going to begin with you. You say that consistency is almost a built-in appetite that lives in our brain, that we're hardwired.
That's exactly right. The brain, at a very basic level, really doesn't particularly like inconsistency. And to kind of understand why that is, you have to look at one of the major things that the brain does, which is it makes predictions. And this is from every simple thing. If I pick up a baseball and I throw it, my brain is making a prediction about where it's going to go. Is it going to go through that glass window? Is it going to be a strike across the plate? And then it's measuring whether those predictions come true. And this process is how we learn things. It's also so important to the brain that our brain actually gives us a little shot of a feel-good chemical called dopamine when we get predictions right. And when we get them wrong, it takes that dopamine away. We don't feel so good. So you have that process at work. And you also have the fact that we are incredibly social creatures. Our brains are really interested in what other brains and other people are doing. And we are not only predicting what we do with baseballs, we're predicting what other people are going to do all the time. And so when we make a prediction about what a person is going to do, and we get it right, we get a really big reward. When we get it wrong, we feel really bad. And we may even feel betrayed. And that's how we often feel when we feel like a politician has flip-flopped on us.
So, but this is all operating at an unconscious level.
Yes.
We just have a sort of general feel good, and at some level in our body we're registering, I like what just happened and I don't like what just happened.
It's a little bit like gambling. It's not a conscious thing. It's like, I'm going to feel good because I just won, but you sure do.
And can the effect wear off? In other words, if you're betrayed time and time again by something, somebody, the baseball that doesn't drop to the ground, do you stop trusting gravity, for example? Do you stop?
You change your predictions. When I said it was tied up with learning, what we learn is not to predict that, if you throw a baseball, five times and it goes up every time, our brain will stop predicting that that ball is going to fall to the ground.
All right. So that's the brain's view of what happens when a politician flip-flops or goes back on his word. I want to turn now to Elise Spiegel. You look at this, and you did on this morning and Morning Edition in a different way. Your picture is bigger than what's happening in the brain.
Well, yes. No. This morning I covered an experiment which was done by this guy named Jamie Barden, which looked in a really clean way at exactly the question that you raised at the beginning of the broadcast. When do we see inconsistency as hypocrisy, and when do we see it as growth? So essentially what this guy did, Jamie Barden did, was he got this group of students and he said, okay, your job is to evaluate the behavior of this political operative named Mike. And then he gave them two pieces of information. The first piece of information that he gave them about Mike was that Mike had thrown this kind of elaborate political fundraiser. He got a little drunk. Then at 2 a.m., he drove home and wrapped his car around a telephone pole. Mm-hmm. And then the second piece of information that the students got about Mike was that he, a month later, went on a radio program, much like this one, and went on a screed about how nobody should ever drive drunk. Okay, so now the question is, how do we interpret this behavior? Is he a hypocrite, somebody whose private and public behavior is inconsistent? Or is he somebody who, like, had a really bad experience with, you know, drunk driving and went on the radio to kind of talk about that? Now, half the time, Mike was presented as a Republican, and half the time he was presented as a Democrat. And the students were either Democrats or Republicans. And what he found was that when the party of the student agreed with the
political party, you
mean. Yeah, the political. Mm-hmm. When the student reading it was a Democrat and Mike was a Democrat, mm-hmm. it was very, very rare that they saw him as a hypocrite. Only like 16% of the time. But if he was the opposite. From the opposite party, then they thought he was a hypocrite. And essentially what this shows us is that our interpretation of what is inconsistent and what is consistent is hopelessly clouded by our social allegiances. Even though most of us and most of the people listening believe that when they draw some kind of conclusion, they are responding to facts, they are responding to realities. In fact, a lot of the time, at least, they're responding to the fact that they're aligned with them or not.
It sounds like if it's your guy,
right?
It's very, very hard for your guy to give you the feeling of being betrayed. You'll zigzag all over the place with him if he zigzags.
That is what this research that I covered this morning would suggest. Yes,
and
exactly.
Does it ever snap? I mean, is there any evidence for you? It comes to a point where the zig is too far, or the zigzag's too frequent that it just breaks?
Oh, I'm sure. Like John was saying. I mean, John might be able to talk about that a little bit better than me. But yeah, certainly.
Okay. Well, we're going to ask you to join this conversation, our listeners. What we want to ask you is: Have you experienced the feeling of being betrayed by a politician in whom you put your trust and your faith and your belief? And what was it that actually caused that to happen? And what we want to do is not necessarily gauge whether you're right or wrong about the politician. We want to have our three experts talk about maybe what's happening inside your head and give you a little bit of an insight to why you experienced it that way. But now I want to turn to our third member of the panel, and Shankar Vedantam, also an NPR science correspondent. What's your take on this consistency issue?
Well, John, so here's how we divided things up. So John Hamilton looked at the role that the brain plays in determining whether people are consistent and why we care so much about consistency. And Elise looked at the fact that we are inconsistent in the way we perceive consistency. And I wanted to take a slightly different tack. What I did was I said, people say they care about consistency. Voters say they want politicians who are consistent. What happens when voters get what they want? In other words, what happens when you get a consistent politician? What's the consequence of getting somebody consistent or inconsistent? And I looked at the research of the psychologist at the Wharton School, whose name is Phil Tetlock, and he has essentially divided the political world into two groups of people whom he called foxes and hedgehogs. And this is based on an ancient Greek aphorism which says, the fox knows many things, but the hedgehog knows one big thing. And Tetlock says there are some leaders who behave like hedgehogs. They know one big thing. They have one big worldview that organizes their thinking on whole bunches of different issues. And these leaders are highly consistent. So if you ask them to explain all manner of things, they will bring up their single worldview to explain, you know, why healthcare is the way it is, or why governments work the way they do, or why foreign policy is the way they do. So somebody who's a free market hedgehog uses the lens of the free market to understand all manner of different things. Somebody who's a fox, on the other hand, has a variety of perspectives on a lot of different issues, and many of those perspectives are inconsistent with one another. So hedgehogs tend to be very consistent, foxes tend to be very inconsistent. And Tetlock, in this massive study he conducted over 20 years, looked at what happens and how accurate foxes and hedgehogs are in making political predictions and predicting what the future was going to look like. And he found that over time, foxes tend to be much more accurate than hedgehogs. So the politicians who are inconsistent tend to be much better at making political forecasts about the future. And as a result, they tend to be much more effective when they're in office because they're able to adapt to a whole variety of circumstances. And he found that hedgehogs, they have a pretty bad batting average, but there's a curious thing about them. When they are right, they can be spectacularly right. So when you think about Winston Churchill, classic hedgehog, you know, he was able to see the threat of Hitler long before anyone else. But he was also spectacularly wrong on a whole bunch of issues. And that's the other thing that hedgehogs do. They can be spectacularly right as well as spectacularly wrong. But foxes, on average, tend to have, you know, a much better batting average.
So have you thought about why that is? Why foxes would be better at prediction? Is it simply that they're so not stuck in their position that they can smell what's in the wind more easily?
Yeah, I think that would be one way of saying it. The other way of interpreting the result is to basically say the world is a complicated place, and the world doesn't lend itself very easily to being reduced to a single worldview. So if I'm a Marxist hedgehog or a free market hedgehog, or the worldview that unifies my thinking is a religious worldview, this isn't really sufficient to deal with the complexity of the world that politicians and leaders actually have to deal with. And foxes, because they actually are not constrained by that single worldview, they're inconsistent, they go from one position to the other, they're much better able to deal with the vagaries of this complex and unpredictable world we live in.
In general, is it your experience that it's actually difficult to box anybody who's out there on the political scene, past or present, in either of these categories, to call somebody, to say that somebody is an inconsistent politician?
I think it absolutely is, because as we've been saying, so much of this is kind of an eye of the beholder thing. Also, like from a biological point of view, you could define the consistency of a person in very different ways. So if the consistency you're looking for is, well, that person is always looking out for the security of the nation, that might one day lead to a decision to declare war, another day to be an isolationist. And you could say, well, you're inconsistent about your worldview there, or you could say, no, you're consistent in this other way. So it's sort of how you look at it.
So inconsistency is not necessarily a liability, except to the extent, John, they say it gives us a little bit of a dopamine drop.
It's a liability if you are perceived as being inconsistent.
Right. Which is why it's such a good campaign slogan to call your opponent inconsistent.
Right.
All right. So we're going to rejoin in a few minutes with the three of you to have you listen to what listeners have said has gone through their minds when they've experienced this moment of betrayal. And maybe you can talk a little bit about what's going through their minds that they haven't actually seen. So we want to have you join us. Our number is 800-989-8255, or you can join us online at npr.org. I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation. We'll be right back. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Donvan. If you were by your radio this morning, you may have heard three NPR science correspondents on Morning Edition talking about flip-flopping politicians. John Hamilton, Elise Spiegel, and Shankar Vedantam looked at why our brains hate inconsistency and the political consequences of flip-flopping and what we mean when we use that term. You can find a link to their story at npr.org. And all three of them are with us here in the studio today. We also want to hear from you. Tell us about a time when a politician whom you trusted changed his or her mind. Did you see it as a betrayal? Or did they do the right thing? The number is 800-989-8255. You can also email talk@npr.org. And we're going to go now to callers and go to Steve in Maple Glen, Pennsylvania. Hi, Steve. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call. The incident that I most vividly recall of a politician going back on what I thought was a pretty firm commitment was the first President Bush, who famously said, "Read my lips, no new taxes," and then during his presidency supported increasing taxes.
That seems to be the symbolic flip flop. I think the term preceded that, but it certainly was accelerated in popular usage at the time. And how did it hit you?
Well, I guess you've used the word betrayed, and that certainly is an accurate word. I mean, taxes are one of my core issues. I assume most people have any number of issues that are important to us, and not everyone's going to agree with us on all of them. But I have some basic core issues. I'd call them my big three. Taxes is one of those. And when I supported him because of his stance on in part on taxes, and when he did a complete reversal, yes, I felt betrayed.
There's no question that it was a 180 or very close to a 180. But one of the questions we were asking also is whether it's possible for you to look at what he did and say, well, he learned something new, or the circumstances changed, and therefore it's not quite a betrayal. What is your take on that, Steve?
Well, yes, that is certainly possible. And I guess one of your panelists said that we tend to give the benefit of the doubt more to people who basically agree with us than those who basically disagree with us, if I'm paraphrasing that accurately. The first George Bush was one who basically agreed with me more than say, Bill Clinton would have. Yet, on the other hand, to me, that was a core issue, a complete reversal, and it's not my recollection, and of course we're a number of years away from that now, but it's not my recollection that the events as they changed between the time he made the pledge and time he broke the pledge warranted that reversal.
All right, John Hamilton, that seems like clear-cut sense of betrayal.
Yeah, and it's really interesting, the language the caller is using. He talks about core values and a core issue. And interestingly enough, that's exactly the same wording that the neuroscientist I talked to for my story is a guy named David Linden at Johns Hopkins. And he repeatedly said, when you get to the stage of betrayal, it's because we believe the person has not only been inconsistent, but they've been inconsistent about something that is at their very core. And when we define it that way, we feel like they've been inconsistent. Forget it. You're done. However, there could be other people who would say, well, maybe the tax thing wasn't a core value. You know, maybe being an economic pragmatist was, and maybe, you know, they were faced with circumstances they couldn't possibly have foreseen when they made that promise of no new taxes. And so it was not a betrayal of a core value.
And I think it probably also depends on how closely identified you are with the person who has done the inconsistent behavior. Mm-hmm. Like in the course of reporting the story, I came across this other work by this this guy named Drew Weston, who's a psychologist, psychiatrist, I guess, down at Emory. And he did this study with people who were kind of rabid partisans during the 2004 election. And he had them look at, like, very clear inconsistent behavior in Kerry and in Bush. And they were just unable to see it as flip-flopping because they were really closely identified. So that's probably another element in what makes us see something
but
as...
At least what I found interesting in Steve's call, and Steve, thank you for your call, was that he seemed to be saying he was a George H.W. Bush guy, and that didn't protect him from feeling betrayed.
Right. But he said he agreed with him more than he agreed with Clinton, as opposed to, like, the population that Drew Weston was looking at were people who were just, you know, they were going door to door. They were doing all that kind of thing. So that might also affect things.
Let's bring in Matt from Syracuse, New York.
Yep.
Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi, I was a liberal student and helped campaign for Obama. And as time went on, I ended up feeling somewhat betrayed and disenchanted after a lot of the things that I expected him to do, he wasn't able to put into practice. But over time, I've actually come to view it as less of a betrayal and more of just a cost of having to make compromises. So I started out feeling betrayed, but I don't feel that way anymore.
And did in the terminology that Shankar gave us of a fox or a hedgehog, where do you put Obama?
That's kind of hard. I would actually put Obama as more of a fox. I feel like he has a lot of different perspectives on different issues and is willing to adapt to the changes in politics and world events.
So, Shankar, is there such a thing as a fox that only looks like a hedgehog and a hedgehog that only looks like a fox?
Well, I think the research seems to suggest that because hedgehogs do so much better during campaigns and foxes do so much better when they're in office, the most effective leaders are indeed foxes who can disguise themselves as hedgehogs so that they govern like foxes but that they campaign like hedgehogs. But both Steve and Matt are raising a really interesting point that actually is at the intersection of something that Elise and John just talked about, which is that on the one hand, we are much less likely to notice inconsistency when it's people on our side. But it's only the inconsistencies of people on our side that we really perceive as betrayal. So in other words, we don't feel betrayed when somebody from the other side breaks their word and starts agreeing with us. We
because think that's that an I told you so.
Yeah, we think they've come to their senses. It's only when, you know, someone on our side who promises us something that we care deeply about that we perceive it as betrayal. So there's an interesting sort of tension here between being able to perceive consistency in people on our side or on another side and then feeling betrayed by the consistencies of people on our own side.
Matt, thanks very much for your call. Let's go to Andrew in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Hi, Andrew. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Yes. I love that you guys are talking about this inconsistency amongst politicians. I think this is a subject that isn't spoken about even in the main political realm that we speak about. Even when it's important this time of age. I think one of the worst things that I think that I've seen when it comes to inconsistency is when Obama had campaigned throughout his entire 2008 race against the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and now he wants to lay claim to the end of the Iraq war when it's really just been the policy of George Bush that has been in place before he even left office. So it's like he's riding on the policies of something that was going to end just to make himself look good for history.
To put things into Elise Spiegel's terms, are you an Obama guy in the beginning or not?
I was just about to ask that question.
No, I didn't really believe him in the beginning. There were certain ways in which I was, I was hoped that he was going to change stuff.
Does the word betrayal then apply? Do you have that awful feeling that?
I think it was a very deceitful betrayal. And not that if adding that word makes it any better or worse.
John Hamilton.
Yeah, the other question I would ask you is, would you say there was a time when you felt like you trusted Obama?
Or somebody who obviously is of a different pigment that kind of just brought it about. I was like, I don't think I still think there's a little bit of racism. Maybe some people call it that, or not call it that, but, they
But you yourself, did you trust him?
Would I trust him? Not anymore, no.
But you did at one point.
Well, because he was new. I think this is probably one of the biggest things that we have these days is when we have somebody new that comes along, we can't have the room of whether we trust them or not until they actually get into office. I think our minds are evolving very quickly right now, that we're beginning to pick up on how soon.
Let me just mention one other area of research that maybe it talks a little bit about what is going on with you, is that there a lot of the research on trust has been done what they call trust games, where you have a situation where you have to trust other players, maybe fictional, maybe real, in order to make money together. Usually there's an incentive. And what's interesting is that initially people have to take a leap of faith and trust. But after that, as you play consecutive rounds, trust is based on reputation and what you have perceived that other person is doing. And you can actually see changes in the brain reactions if you look at people's brains, where they either there's a trust growing because somebody's acted consistently and done what they said, or the trust is diminishing because they maybe took all the money and ran with it.
That's why I'm a Ron Paul supporter now.
There you go.
Andrew, thanks very much for your call. Well, it helped him make a choice. Something else, John, you mentioned in the morning program that the pain of betrayal is nearly physical.
Yeah, that comes from there's a line of research where people have looked at how, we speak in metaphor about when we're hurt by a heartache, or we talk about betrayal as hurting, as if we had broken an arm or something. And what's interesting is that when you look at the parts of the brain that respond, actually many of the same exact areas that would respond to physical pain respond and light up with emotional pain.
Let's go to Janice in Holly Pond, Alabama. Hi, Janice. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi.
Well, my moment is that Richard Shelby was elected senator from Alabama as a Democrat and immediately switched to Republican.
Was he a fox or a hedgehog when he was running for office?
I think he was probably a hedgehog.
So he outfoxed you, is what you're saying, I think.
Yeah, I consider him a snake now.
Just to get one more animal in there.
Yeah, getting into some zoology. Shankar.
I have to say, one of the really interesting psychological theories I've come about is something that psychologists call the fundamental attribution error. And so both, when Janice is talking about Richard Shelby and Andrew talked about Obama a second ago, you know, when a politician changes his or her mind, one of the things that we have to do is to try and understand, well, what's going on in the politician's mind? Why did they change their mind? Did they change their mind because they were a snake all along, or did they change their mind because the context changed? So as far as Janice is concerned, you know, Richard Shelby is a snake. And as far as Andrew is concerned, you know, Obama is extremely untrustworthy. But here's the interesting thing, and here's where the fundamental attribution error comes about. Psychologists say that when it comes to the behavior of our own behavior and the behavior of our friends, we're much more likely to see changes in behavior as being driven by context. And when we see our opponents, our political opponents, changing course or changing their behavior, we're much more likely to see it in dispositional terms. So we're likely not to say Richard Shelby had a number of issues that he was dealing with, or Obama has a number of issues that he's grappling with, and he's adapting. These politicians are adapting to what they're going through. We're much more likely to say this person is fundamentally a bad person. This person is fundamentally untrustworthy.
Janice, oh, go ahead.
Elizabeth. Oh, no, right, which helps explain kind of the work that I covered this morning in my story. Essentially, when it's you, it's context. When it's another person, it's character. When it's your enemy, it's about character.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. Janice, in terms of Richard Shelby, I mean, do you, because of that particular act, did you consider it a betrayal because you had given him your vote as the member of one party? Was it his party identification that mattered to you?
I'm not so sure that it was his party. It was just that he had been elected as a Democrat, and to me, Democrats stand for one thing, much more liberal causes, and then Republicans are much more conservative of that. And so I really think that he switched parties because it was very hard at that time for a Republican to get elected in Alabama. And so that's what a lot of people thought.
So, but what's interesting there is that you are making the effort to go into his mind and understand why he did it.
Which I actually recognize that he's done some good things for the state as a senator, but I still felt very betrayed when he switched parties immediately.
Did you experience it almost as a physical pain, as John Hamilton is saying? We almost might feel it. It's that rough.
No, it wasn't that bad of that. It was more like of, oh, yeah, can't trust a politician.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, thanks. Oh, John Hamilton.
Yeah, I was going to say that what Janice is talking about brings up one other area of research, and that has to do with how we evolve to be in groups. And, you know, we now live in very, very large groups, although we divide ourselves in, you know, by politics and so on. But, you know, long ago, thousands of years ago, we were in relatively small groups, and it was extremely important whether somebody was in your group and would therefore be trusted, or in another group, in which case you didn't trust them at all. And to have somebody switch groups is going against thousands of years of evolution. Mm-hmm.
All right, Janice, thanks very much for your call. Go ahead, Shankar.
Well, I was just going to say that both Janice and the previous caller had also raised a really interesting issue, which is that in both Richard Shelby's case, as well as in the case of George H.W. Bush, the reason we perceive their inconsistency is because they did something very, very, very specific. So in George H.W. Bush's case, he basically said, read my lips, no new taxes, and then he raised taxes. You know, and in Shelby's case, he switched parties. Now, politicians have become very skilled at making statements that allow them wiggle room, that, you know, you can't perceive if they're actually being consistent or inconsistent because they have what they call plausible deniability, yeah. That they can actually say, you know, that's not actually what I meant to say. But this actually highlights the importance of actually, I think, asking politicians to be specific in what it is that they're advocating.
But voters are somewhat onto that, I think, when they watch somebody do a very contorted backpedal. And literally parse out what they said the first time and how it wasn't exactly the same the second time. I'm not sure that covers you from the betrayal charge. I don't know. So we've got some listener email I'd like to share. Not only are the politicians hedgehogs and foxes, but the populists are hedgehogs and foxes. Mm-hmm. I certainly consider myself a fox. Your caller, who was so disappointed by George Bush's no new taxes pledge break, is clearly a hedgehog. Interesting point. Anybody want to take that up?
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case, that listeners and voters are clearly foxes and hedgehogs as well. And if you look at the betrayal statistics, I suspect that hedgehogs are likely to be the voters who are likely to feel the most betrayed, because they have a worldview, they support a leader with the same worldview, that worldview gets challenged or is inconsistent in some way. That's much more likely to feel like betrayal compared to a fox who says, well, I think smaller government is good in this situation, but I actually am a fan of government in that situation. It's much more easy, I think, for a fox to perceive changes in positions as contextual than it is for a hedgehog.
Another one that actually kind of goes directly to your point. Do we want politicians that don't listen to us? Can someone really listen to another without being willing to change? That's the ultimate fox voter, actually. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so the curious thing is, of course, when you ask voters, do you want politicians who are completely consistent and who are unable to change their views, most voters say no. We want people who would be able to adapt to the complexities of office. But when politicians change their minds, voters get upset. So really what I think voters want is they want a politician who will consistently agree with them.
Everybody seems to want that. I want to thank our guests, John Hamilton, Elise Beagle, and Shankar Vedantam, for joining us on this discussion about consistency, inconsistency, flip-flops, hedgehogs, and foxes. Coming up shortly, we'll be talking with Soraya Shamali about her recent piece on the Catholic Church. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan from NPR News.